Joel Loveleen was a gentle giant. Standing 6'4" and weighing approximately 250 pounds, he was a tower of a man who was secretly a teddy bear that loved to have fun. In October of 2007, he took his new fiancée, Heather Eastling, out to a Halloween party at a local bar called the Broken Drum. Heather dressed as a cute mechanic, while Joel wore the bright green hockey jersey of his favorite team, the University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux. It was going to be a night of fun, and the next day, Joel would be attending the confirmation of his daughter, Alexa, whom he adored. The night was going well, with hands of blackjack, a few drinks, and maybe even a few tugs on a cigar. Joel and Heather were enjoying each other's company, discussing future events, such as their wedding, which was scheduled to take place on August 8, 2008. The crowd was a little thicker than usual, with it being a Halloween party, and the arrival of a party bus which had poured out 40 to 50 20-somethings who were touring from bar to bar that night. Late in the evening, Joel's cell phone rang, and he told Heather that he was going to step outside and take the call. It was a little noisy in the bar. While out there, he noticed a man who seemed a little lost, and he came back in to tell Heather that he thought the guy might have been left behind, and he was going to check on him. Joel kissed Heather on the cheek and walked out of the bar, but he would never walk back in. Moments later, a woman came running in screaming for someone to call 911. Heather grabbed a bouncer to help her find Joel and to figure out what was going on outside when she made a grisly discovery. Joel was laying on the pavement. His blood was everywhere, and he had been violently and viciously beaten nearly beyond recognition. An ambulance arrived and ushered Joel to the hospital, but it was too late, and Joel was gone. Police came into a chaotic scene of costumed individuals who were excessively drunk and had the difficult task of trying to get statements from intoxicated people, and also faced the problem that the party bus was gone. They immediately dispatched units to search local bars for the bus and potential witnesses or suspects. From here on out, the suspect list became a sordid cast of characters. A crying clown, an angry hunter, a cowboy who refused to give his real name, a gangster rapper and a construction worker, and a yellow-hooded lion. The lion, identified as Travis Stay, would ultimately become the prime suspect for the murder when it was found that he had allegedly been violent earlier in the evening and his clothing was splattered with Joel's blood. He was also so drunk that he could not remember what happened that night. Stay was charged and tried, but the trial became a story of pointing fingers and establishing reasonable doubt, and ultimately, Stay was found not guilty. Now without the evidence to have gotten a conviction, and no new leads, authorities found themselves searching for answers and struggling to accept that their prime suspect cannot be tried again. Who murdered Joel Loveleen? And for what reason? Was it a total stranger who had too much to drink and became violent? Could it have been someone who knew Joel and had a reason to want to take him out? Did an angry group of partiers attack the large man because he was defending Travis Stay? Or did Travis Stay himself murder the very much larger Joel by using his kindness and good-hearted nature to blindside him with a violent assault? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 31, The Murder of Joel Loveleen. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode examines the brutal murder of Joel Loveleen, a hardworking, good-hearted man who was violently mauled outside of a North Dakota bar during a Halloween party. It's a very confusing case, with a long list of possibilities. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on missing persons and unsolved murders. We are available across multiple platforms and on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and many more. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. It can be found at patreon.com/traceevidence. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you enjoy it and wish to help support it, please check out the Patreon page. I've also set up a one-time PayPal donation link on the main website for those of you who wish to contribute but don't want to use Patreon. Links, information, and more items, including YouTube videos and full episode transcripts, can be found on the website at trace-evidence.com. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Tweet me at traceevpod, that's TRACEEVPOD. Add me on Instagram at traceevidencepod, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence Podcast or clicking the direct link on the website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. As a final note, if you enjoy the show, please rate and review it on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews the show gets, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to the cases that I cover. Today I look into the murder of Joel Loveleen. It's a startlingly shocking and tragic case with a confusing list of suspects and a lot of debate on all sides of the story. It involves a short trial that ultimately raised more questions than it answered, and a family shattered by a devastating loss. This is episode 31, The Murder of Joel Loveleen. Joel Loveleen was born on October 8, 1969 in Bismarck, North Dakota, to Marvin Loveleen and Judy Berglund. Bismarck is the capital of North Dakota and its second largest city, behind only Fargo, and has a population of 72,000. The city is approximately 31.23 square miles, and its capitol building juts up as the tallest and most recognizable building in the skyline. Joel was an active child, described by many as a sensitive boy who loved to laugh and to make others laugh. Joel would go on to attend West Junior High School in Great Falls from 1982 to 1985. Later in the year, his family would pick up stakes and move to Bagley, Minnesota, approximately 300 miles northeast of Bismarck. Bagley is a small city in Clearwater County and holds a population of just over 1,300. It is there that Joel attended Bagley High School, graduating in 1988. After graduating from high school, Joel went on to attend the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. He pursued and graduated with a degree in math and computer science. Early on, he began working in information services at the Grand Forks Clinic, later going on to be a technical systems analyst for AllTrue Healthcare Systems. On March 20, 1992, Joel married Heidi Hosley, and together they had a daughter, whom they named Alexa. He was a doting father who, friends and family all agree, had a real zest for life and loved spending time with his daughter more than anything else. Though his marriage with Heidi ultimately ended, the two remained on amicable terms and co-parented their daughter. When Joel later met and fell in love with Heather Eastling, the two women would be friendly to one another, though following Joel's death, they would find strength in one another, with Heidi later saying, quote, "We have a man we loved in common. We have my daughter who she also loves," end quote. Joel and Heather's romance was a whirlwind, with both falling fast and hard for one another. Joel had been married before, and though he had a hesitance, Heather was irresistible to him, and he knew early on that she was the only one he'd been looking for, a sweet, kind, and beautiful grade school teacher. Joel's obituary described Heather as the love of his life. The two had been together for less than a year, but their bond was so strong that they didn't want to waste any time, and became engaged, with their wedding set to take place on August 8, 2008. Or 888. Joel was a kind man with a big heart who cared greatly for his family, which had many divisions to it. Joel had a sister, as well as two half-brothers and three step-brothers. In his leisure time, he enjoyed golf and bowling, as well as spending time with his friends and family. He was a lifelong fan of the University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux hockey team. In October of 2007, Joel and Heather decided to celebrate Halloween by going to a costume party. It was being held at the Broken Drum Bar and Grill, located on North Washington Street in Grand Forks. The party was on Saturday, October 27th, and both had chosen their costumes. Joel would be wearing his green Fighting Sioux hockey jersey, while Heather would be dressed as a mechanic. The two arrived and shared a few drinks together, playing a couple of hands of blackjack while Joel indulged in a cigar. The bar was busier than usual due to the party, and the atmosphere was injected by a large group of younger people. A party bus had arrived, letting out approximately 40 to 50 people in their early 20s. The Broken Drum was just one stop along the way, and for the most part, everyone was enjoying the spirit of the evening and dancing in their costumes. Amongst those who stepped off the bus were a cowboy, a lion, a hunter, a clown, a Paris Hilton, and a gangster. Interestingly, though North Dakota is far from the most populous state, it has more bars per capita than any other state in the country. This made the party bus rather busy that night, ushering its patrons around from bar to bar. The bus was meant to leave the Broken Drum around 11:30 p.m. to move on to the next destination. Right around this time, as Heather recalls, Joel's phone rang, and in order to avoid the noise of the bar and hear the caller, he told her he was going to step outside. A few minutes later, Joel returned and told Heather that he thought someone had missed the bus. According to Heather, Joel said, quote, "Hey, somebody got left by the bus, I'm gonna go check on him," end quote. At this point, Joel kissed her on the cheek and walked outside. Neither Heather nor anyone else present at the bar could have expected what would happen next, and that Joel would never walk back inside. Adding even more tragedy to this horrifying story is that Joel hadn't planned on staying too late, as he was attending his daughter's confirmation just the next day. Moments after Joel exited the bar, a female patron came running inside screaming for someone to call 911. Heather wasn't immediately concerned, but got up from her seat and went outside to see what was going on and to ask Joel what had happened. To her shock and horror, she discovered it was Joel who needed medical assistance. According to a statement made later, Heather said, quote, "Joel was lying there with blood all over the cement near his head in the parking lot. We couldn't get a response out of him," end quote. The ambulance arrived, and Joel was hurried away to the very hospital in which he worked as a systems analyst. Despite their best efforts, surgeons were unable to save Joel's life. According to doctors, Joel had been severely beaten and multiple bones in his face were broken. It was determined that, sadly, Joel had choked to death on his own blood. Dr. Mary Ann Sens, a Grand Forks coroner, would perform an autopsy on Joel the following day. Ultimately, she agreed with doctors about his cause of death and said it was as a result of his severe facial injuries. She described Joel's face as being flattened and later stated, quote, "When you actually touched his face, you could hear the bones crunching," end quote. According to Dr. Sens, the injuries to Joel were focused primarily on his face, head, and upper torso. No significant injuries were found on his extremities, nor were there offensive injuries such as cuts on his hands, suggesting that whomever had attacked Joel had likely surprised him and left him no chance to fight back. Sens believed that fists could have caused the injuries, though there was the possibility of a foot or a fairly broad object without well-defined edges. Sens also found blood pooled in Joel's testicles, about which she would say it was very unusual and, quote, "I cannot prove or disprove any injury to that area," end quote. Sens would go on to say that Joel suffered blunt force trauma to the head and speculated that it was possible his head had been bashed against the ground. She found no trace of blood on his pants, which suggests that when Joel was bleeding, he wasn't standing up with the blood dripping down. This would infer that someone had gotten Joel onto the ground quickly, which could be challenging considering that he was nearly 6'4" tall and weighed approximately 240 to 250 pounds. Suffice it to say, Joel cut an imposing figure, and being that no offensive wounds were found on him, someone had to have blindsided him and taken advantage while he was grounded. Police arrived on the scene and had a tremendously chaotic situation to deal with. The party bus had left, which escorted away 40 to 50 possible witnesses and/or suspects of the attack. There were approximately 80 patrons left inside the bar, many of which were intoxicated and unable to provide much helpful information. In addition to this, many of those who may have seen something couldn't identify anyone by name, since most every person there that night was in a costume. Police were given the descriptions of individuals who had been near or interacting with Joel in the hours and moments leading up to the attack, but it was essentially like a list of villains from an episode of the 1960s Batman. If it wasn't so incredibly tragic and horrifying, it might have been funny. The descriptions included a clown, a cowboy, a gangster, a hunter, a lion, and a construction worker. Grand Forks Police Chief John Packett later stated, quote, "If you're going to find the Penguin and the Joker and the rest of them, you've got to find them pretty quickly," end quote. After getting information about the party bus, the Grand Forks police sent units to nearby bars to try and track down members of that tour. Outside of statements from witnesses who didn't see the altercation but remembered Joel in his bright green hockey jersey, investigators were able to come upon some physical evidence. Not far from the spot where Joel had been found unconscious, they discovered a piece of yellow fabric. At first, it appeared to be just a random swatch of clothing, but upon further inspection, it turned out to be a homemade foot or paw from a Halloween costume. It was stained with blood. Forensic tests would later show that it was, in fact, Joel Loveline's blood on the yellow cloth. At a nearby bar, authorities located the clown, who turned out to be 22-year-old John DeZiel. When officers approached him, they found DeZiel distressed. He was crying, and according to authorities, his hands were shaking. One officer reported that DeZiel stated, quote, "I guess things got out of hand tonight," end quote. Officers were immediately suspicious of his behavior, though DeZiel brushed it off, saying that he was upset because he'd broken up with his girlfriend, and that the attack on Loveline reminded him of when he and his brother had been jumped a year earlier. DeZiel stated that he had been knocked unconscious during the altercation the prior year and had awoken in a pool of blood. DeZiel quickly stopped answering questions and requested a lawyer, at which point he was brought down to the station for further questioning. The cowboy was located next and identified as 23-year-old Bryce Larson. Larson was later described as the man who had organized the party bus. Strangely, when initially approached by police, Larson asked a question which immediately drew their suspicion. While asking if he knew anything about the assault which had taken place earlier in the night, Larson replied by asking, quote, "Had the guy that died been wearing a green shirt with the initials UND on it?" end quote. Of course, Joel had been wearing his University of North Dakota hockey jersey. He is also reported to have seen blood on the man's face, but claimed to witness no altercation. Another suspicious detail about Larson, when interviewed initially by police, he's reported to have given them a false name, birth date, and to have been physically aggressive. He was cuffed until he calmed down, but was not arrested nor charged. Due to their intoxication and resistance, police requested to speak to both the cowboy and the clown again the next morning at the station. They found both DeZiel and Larson more cooperative and less aggressive when they were sober. According to authorities, the men told a compelling story which they felt cleared them of possible involvement. DeZiel and Larson explained that two of the passengers on the bus had gotten into a fight outside of the bar. They explained that a man dressed in a lion costume, which appeared to be made out of a customized yellow hoodie, had accosted a friend of theirs who was, ironically, dressed as a hunter. According to them, the man dressed as a lion had grabbed the hunter by the collar and violently pulled him to the ground. The hunter was identified as 22-year-old James Wavra. According to DeZiel and Larson, the lion swung a punch but missed, and Wavra fought back, and was allowed back on the bus, but the lion was banned from riding further with them. Wavera was questioned about this, and he stated, quote, "I recalled hitting the man a total of one or two times and kicking him in the shoulder or the side of the face," end quote. According to Larson, following the incident, he and two of his friends were angry with the man dressed as a lion and decided that they wanted to confront him. The mixture of alcohol and the previous altercation had brought out some aggression in them. His two friends were the Gangster, later clarified to actually be a gangsta rapper, a costume worn by 23-year-old Mitchell Dolan, and 23-year-old Josh DeZiel, dressed as a construction worker, who also happened to be the older brother of John DeZiel, the clown. Josh would later state that he wanted to confront the guy and that he turned to Dolan and said, quote, "Let's go give this guy some grief," end quote. It was at this point that they went to look for the lion, but found him standing next to the imposing figure of Joel Loveline, and there wasn't enough alcohol in their systems for them to feel courageous enough to confront his towering figure. According to later testimony, there was a conversation between them and Joel, but no violence took place, and the talk was not heated. Larson and DeZiel would state that there was another man there, nearby, at the time they were talking to Joel. They were unable to give much information other than the fact that this unknown man was white and was wearing some sort of a costume, which is a description that would match almost everyone attending that party that night who was male and white. Eventually, authorities managed to track down and interview almost everyone who had been on the party bus that night. None of them recalled seeing an altercation involving Joel, though many of them remembered the fight between the lion and the hunter. In addition to this, none of them remembered seeing anyone come aboard the bus that night with blood or any outward sign that they had been in a fight. Of course, James Wavera, the hunter, had been in a fight that night. He just didn't look like he had. So could someone have viciously assaulted Joel and then hopped on board without being noticed? All interviewed bus riders stated that they were not lying nor trying to cover up for anyone. At the time, the identity of the lion remained unknown. Authorities issued a statement requesting anyone who had been at the Broken Drum that night to come forward, even if they didn't feel like they had seen anything helpful. You never know what details someone might dismiss that could be the key to finding the answers. They also mentioned that they were on the lookout for whoever had been dressed as the lion that night, and much to their surprise, a 23-year-old nursing student named Travis Stay walked into the police department 2 days later. He explained that he had been dressed in a yellow hoodie, which he had fashioned into a lion costume, and had heard that they might be looking for him, and he wanted to cooperate in any way that he could. Officers quickly noted that Stay had bruises on his face and cuts on his hands. Initially, police wanted to get their hands on the hoodie to make a comparison between that and the bloody yellow fabric found at the crime scene, but as Stay explained, he'd thrown it away. Detective Dwayne Simon asked Stay why he threw it out, and he responded, quote, "because it was full of blood," end quote. Stay explained that he had been assaulted by the hunter, James Wavera, but also that he couldn't remember a great deal of the night. He'd been extremely drunk, and his memory was vague and foggy at best. Stay handed over his clothing and shoes from the garbage, without the need of a warrant, nor the presence of a lawyer, and was very cooperative. Further testing on his clothing would show that the yellow fabric matched the hoodie. It would also show that he had Joel Loveline's blood all over his costume. Though Stay couldn't remember the night's events, he was adamant that he wouldn't have hurt anyone. Of course, according to James Wavera, he had assaulted him for no reason. Police attempted to put together a timeline of Stay's travels that night, and during the course of the investigation, they found yet another witness who claimed that Stay had attempted to assault him. Steve Razaka, a 49-year-old man, explained that on the night of the murder, he had been walking home from a friend's house and was in the 2000 block of 10th Avenue North, about a half mile from the Broken Drum, when he noticed a man in a yellow hoodie following him. Razaka stated, quote, "I took that he was rather intoxicated because he couldn't walk a straight line," end quote. According to Razaka, as he approached his home, the man in the hoodie came up behind him and took a swing at him, but missed, making this the second time this night that Stay had allegedly swung at someone and failed to connect. Rusaka said the man had blood on his forehead and a bandage on his hand. After the swing, Rusaka ran inside and grabbed a baseball bat, but when he returned to the front of his home, the man in the yellow hoodie had vanished. Police also spoke to Paul Ballstad, a taxi driver who had picked up Stay that night from near the cemetery at Columbia Road and Gateway Drive, nearly a mile from the broken drum, sometime after 1 a.m. According to Ballstad, quote, "I looked up at his face and he was covered in blood, hairline to neck, and covering the whole front of his face, kind of like it was a mask," end quote. According to Ballstad, Stay was extremely distracted, obviously very drunk, and seemed out of it. Ballstad offered to take him somewhere to take care of his injuries, though Stay seemed disinterested. He had to ask multiple times for the destination, as Stay was too drunk to focus for very long. Eventually, he did drop Stay off at his apartment without incident. With the combination of eyewitness testimony, enough evidence they felt to support that Stay had been violent and aggressive that night, as well as witnesses who placed him near Joel prior to the murder and the bloody clothing, police arrested Travis Stay and charged him with the murder of Joel Loveline. The prosecution would go on to argue that Stay had been beaten up by James Wavera, and when Joel had attempted to help him and check on him, he had violently attacked the Good Samaritan. It was an interesting theory, though there was one piece of it the jury had a difficult time believing. Could the 5'9", 160-pound Travis Stay have successfully attacked the 6'4", 240, 250 Joel without getting severely beaten? And in the details about Stay's attempted punch on two other men that night, and failing, it became difficult to swallow that he could successfully knock Joel to the ground. Stay's defense attorney had a lot to argue against, but managed to build a great possibility of reasonable doubt. To counter the blood evidence, he cross-examined Dr. Sens, the coroner who had examined Joel, and she admitted that while the blood on Stay's clothing was in fact Joel's and was consistent with an attack, it was also possible, since Joel had died from choking on his own blood, that he could have been coughing up blood and this could explain how it got onto Stay. On the other hand, she also said that when she examined Joel, he had gum in his mouth, which she wouldn't expect to find if he had been coughing enough to put that much blood on Stay. The defense also argued that Stay was much smaller than Joel and had failed in his attempts to assault others that night, making it highly unlikely that he could have been in any position to have caused the injuries which resulted in Joel's death. It was also made clear that there were others on the bus who had acted aggressively that night, many people were intoxicated, and that the testimony of other witnesses was flawed. A key piece of evidence provided by the defense had to do with John DeZiel, the clown. In DeZiel's testimony, he stated that Joel was not outside when the bus left, but surveillance footage showed Joel exiting the bar for the final time, and then 3.5 minutes later, DeZiel exiting the bar, and it had already been confirmed that DeZiel had left on the bus. This made it clear that DeZiel had either lied or made an error, and neither he nor anyone else on the bus had yet left at the time Joel was outside. A bouncer also claimed that the party bus was still there when he was helping Heather and they were looking for Joel. This was an important detail as a detective later testified that they had approached the case under the assumption that the bus had been gone when Joel had been attacked, which ultimately proved that there were other possible suspects who had not been properly questioned or pursued. Stay's trial was short, lasting only 9 days. After the prosecution and defense had presented all of their evidence, it took the jury only 5 hours to find Stay innocent. The jury felt the biggest issue with the prosecution's case was the timeline, and the fact that, since the party bus had in fact not left prior to the murder, there were any number of suspects who could have been responsible and had not been investigated. Stay's attorney found the investigation flawed and said it was the fault of, quote, "the police for not running down leads in the case, not analyzing the clothing and shoes of the 5 men the defense accused of killing Loveline, and for not interrogating them the same way as Stay," end quote. The defense had argued that the hunter, clown, and construction worker, Wavra, Larson, and Josh DeZiel are the likely culprits, and that they had attacked Joel when he'd attempted to defend Stay. It also looked good for Stay that when he heard the police were looking for him, he came in willingly, cooperated, handed over potential evidence, and did not request a lawyer until he was charged with murder. He had previously been working toward a career in nursing, but following the trial, switched to law and became a clerk for one of his defense attorneys. Stay's family and friends were exuberant over the acquittal, though Joel's loved ones felt they had been robbed of justice. They still strongly believed that Stay was, at a minimum, involved in Joel's murder. Loveline's ex-wife Heidi, when asked about it afterwards, stated, quote, "I believe someday it won't be an earthly justice, but someday God will take care of it, and that's the only way I can go." End quote. One juror, when asked about the decision, stated, quote, "My unrest comes because I don't want the Loveline family to think ill of the jury. Our hope is that the police and state's attorney keep looking into this case. Someone might crack it someday. Joel is a man I wish I knew, and his family should know I consider Joel a true hero. He is the kind of person that would put down his life for another person's welfare. May God bless him. But Travis was a victim in this too." End quote. Joel's fiance, Heather Easterling, still has questions, asking, quote, "How do you get blood in the crotch of your pants? Not just the front of your crotch, the back crotch too, if you're not standing above him while blood is being splattered." End quote. Joel's daughter, Alexa, 16 at the time of the trial, wanted little involvement with the case. Though she had hoped for justice for her father, she knew nothing was going to bring him back, and that's truly all she wanted, to see her father alive again. Sadly, Joel was viciously murdered, and justice remains unserved. Stay himself was fairly quiet following the verdict, only reasserting his statements that he knew he would be exonerated because he wasn't involved. Interestingly, even in the trial, Stay admitted that he couldn't remember most of the night. Is it possible that Stay committed this crime and simply doesn't remember it? Absolutely. Though the numbers vary from report to report, it is known that the party bus had trays and trays and trays of Jell-O shots, as well as the drinks which were gotten at various bars. Stay's level of intoxication has never been debated. After all of the evidence has been weighed and the suspects put under the microscope of public and private scrutiny, there remains no answers as to who was responsible for Joel's murder. In the absence of solid evidence and a provable possibility, several theories have risen to popularity. The first theory is that Joe was attacked by a yet unidentified suspect. Supporters of this theory point to the revelation that the party bus had not left the scene of the crime prior to the murder, and that at least one witness saw Joel standing with an unidentified white male. It is considered possible that Joel may have offered assistance to Stay, who drunkenly refused and stalked off, and in that moment, he could have been viciously assaulted by someone else. It was a Halloween party, and the alcohol was flowing, and the combination of alcohol and aggression typically doesn't go well. This would also fall into the category of simply being a random act and not premeditated. The second theory is that which has been put forth by Travis Stay's defense team, that Bryce Larson, Josh DeZiel, James Wavra, John DeZiel, and Mitchell Dalen may have together or in some combination gone after Stay and ultimately ended up in an altercation with Joel that led to his murder. Proponents of this theory point to Joel's size and the likelihood that the extreme injuries to his face may have been the result of multiple attackers. In addition to this, being that Joel had no offensive wounds, many argue that he was likely rushed by more than one person and tackled to the ground while others began hitting him, making it impossible for him to have defended himself in the first place. The final theory is that which the prosecution argued, that Travis Stay, in a violent, drunken rage, blindsided Joel and savagely beat him to death. Despite the fact that he was acquitted by a jury, many feel that this acquittal came as a result of a failure of the police and the prosecutor to tighten up their timeline and investigate all aspects of the case, but they do consider it possible that Stay committed the crime and got lucky in that there were errors in the investigation. Others believe Stay's story, but feel that since he openly admits to blacking out, he may have committed the murder and not even remember it. This would hardly be the first time someone did something terrible while under the influence and failed to recall the details. Ultimately, for many, including the police, Travis Stay is still considered the prime suspect. Due to the double jeopardy law, even if new evidence were to arise, Stay could not be tried for this murder again. The murder of Joel Loveline is a horrifying tale about a kind man who stepped outside to help someone he didn't know and paid the ultimate price for his desire to aid another person. His family has been left devastated, wondering why such a wonderful person was taken from them, apparently without reason. His daughter must now grow up in a world without justice and without the care and love of a father who would have done anything for her. Joel's fiancée, Heather, lost the love of her life and had her world torn apart. She still thinks of Joel every day and hopes for answers and something to make sense of it all, though even a conviction someday will not make this crime any less senseless. Over 10 years have gone by since Joel was murdered, and all the questions remain unanswered. How does a man step outside of a very busy bar, get viciously assaulted and murdered, but no one sees or hears anything? How does a man have Joel's blood all over him, and yet supply no answers as to what happened to Joel? It's an incredibly frustrating case with a bizarre cast of characters and no obvious answers. Hopefully, someday, the truth about what happened to Joel will come out, and someone will be held accountable for murdering a good man whose kindness was repaid with violence. Though no solution can ever bring him back, we can only hope that justice will be served, and that those who loved him may find peace in the revelation of the truth. The murder of Joel Loveline is a case I've been studying for a while. It's a highly complicated story involving a lot of different people, all with varying viewpoints, mixed with alcohol and costumes. There's a great deal of physical evidence available, a murder trial has taken place, and yet we have no answers. It's a real-life whodunit, with extreme consequences, and at the core is the viciously violent murder of a man who, by all accounts, was a beautiful human being who deserves so much more. It's a story that shouldn't have to be told, and it's a crime that shouldn't have happened in the first place. A man takes his fiancée out for a fun night at a Halloween party, steps outside to check on a total stranger, and ends up being murdered. This case has gotten a decent amount of attention, including a Dateline special titled Under a Halloween Moon. Yet, despite the media coverage, including a very public trial, things have grown exceedingly quiet in the 10 years since Joel was murdered. Oftentimes, in a case like this, where you have so much evidence and information, it can be almost as frustrating as the cases with no evidence. You would think it's totally solvable, and yet it remains a terrible crime where no one's been held accountable. The argument's been made that there is a prime suspect, but when a jury of his peers finds him innocent, there isn't much more that can be done. Simply because a jury found someone innocent doesn't necessarily mean that he is, but in the eyes of the law, it does mean that their hands are now tied. For those of you who are unaware, the Constitution's Fifth Amendment explains that no person shall be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, which means that if you're tried for a murder and found not guilty, you can't be tried for that murder again. It's simultaneously a good and a bad thing, but ultimately, that's why in the American court system, you're presumed innocent and must be proven guilty. The burden of proof is on the prosecution. The Loveline family could bring a civil suit against Travis Stay, much like the Goldman and Brown families did with O.J. Simpson, but it would result in a monetary consequence rather than a criminal prosecution. This case is one of the more thoroughly debated ones that I've examined, as people here tend to pick a side and stick with it. The major split is whether or not someone believes that Travis Stay is responsible or not. Both sides of the argument are vehemently defensive of their position and aggressive against the other. Out of this battle, we have several theories, all of which present possibilities as to what could have happened, none of which can be proven beyond the shadow of a doubt. Despite a large quantity of evidence, there are contradictions involved and pieces of information which support each of these possibilities. The first theory is that Joel Loveleen was murdered by a yet unnamed suspect who hasn't been on anyone's radar and has managed to avoid detection for all these years. Joel was at the Broken Drum that night. There was a Halloween party, which was already drawing in a larger crowd than usual. And we have the influx of people from the so-called party bus. A lot of strange faces, many of which were covered by makeup, masks, or other costume accessories. The alcohol was flowing, and the possibility that this attack could have been random or committed by someone who hasn't been looked at is huge, frankly. Joel was a large man, and you wouldn't think that someone would want to start with him. But alcohol gives people more courage and stupidity than they might normally have if they were sober. Everything about this theory is speculative, but there's a myriad of possibilities here. Someone who knew Joel and has a dislike for him may have seen an opportunity and taken it. Someone who didn't know him may have gotten angry about something stupid. Perhaps Joel bumped into someone, or someone's girlfriend was looking at him a little too long. We do know that Bryce Larson, Josh DeZiel, and Mitchell Dolan said that there was an unknown white male in the area near Joel, outside, shortly before the murder took place. Ultimately, the only information they had was that he was white and he was wearing a costume. That description essentially makes up many of the patrons of the bar that night and makes them all into potential suspects. And if this unknown person had murdered Joel and then fled the scene, he could be difficult to track down. Again, it's purely speculative, but this has to be considered possible. Normally, considering how violent the attack was, I'd want to say that it was personally motivated. But we're dealing with a lot of drunk people here, and it isn't uncommon for alcohol to bring out the beast in someone. In addition to that, drunken fights can often get out of hand, and the brutality of the murder may be more associated with the level of the killer's intoxication, rather than a feeling of being motivated by something personal. We now know that the party bus had not left before Joel was murdered, which increases the possible suspect pool even higher. It's entirely possible that Joel was murdered by someone who has never even been considered a suspect in this crime. And considering some people's blackout nature when it comes to alcohol, there could be someone out there right now who murdered Joel and doesn't even know that he did it, though I consider that a little unlikely. There would have been blood all over the killer's clothing, and you'd think he would have put two and two together the next day. That being said, this is a theory which cannot be ruled out and has to be considered possible. I don't believe it's the most likely scenario, but it isn't completely out of the realm of possibility that Joel was murdered by someone we've yet to hear about. Since we know that the party bus was still there and did not leave prior to Joel stepping outside, although there is some confusion about that since Joel allegedly said that he was going to check on someone who had been left from the bus, that leads us to our second theory, that Joel was murdered by one, all, or some combination of the men who had an issue with Travis Stay that night, namely Bryce Larson, Josh DeZiel, James Wavra, John DeZiel, and Mitchell Dalen. It's been established that there was an altercation between James Wavra and Travis Stay that night, though the details are disputed, with Wavra and the others asserting that Stay assaulted him, and Wavra responded by knocking him down and kicking him. Stay argues that Wavra attacked him without provocation, though it's hard to know for sure either way since, again, alcohol was involved and everyone was drunk. We do know, and it has been publicly stated, that at least Larson, Josh DeZiel, and Mitchell Dalen considered going after Stay due to the incident. According to them, when they went to confront him, they found Stay standing next to the imposing figure of Joel Loveleen and thought it might not be such a great idea after all. Their story alleges that they talked to Joel for a few minutes, with Josh DeZiel saying he joked with Joel about a rivalry between Joel's favorite University of North Dakota Fighting Sioux and another team. DeZiel went on to say that the conversation was friendly, and the two men laughed, saying that they would have to see what happened the next time the two teams played one another. Stay's defense attorney in the trial cross-examined Bryce Larson and directly asked him, quote, The truth is that it got out of hand, and you three guys, with about 600 pounds between you, kicked the hell out of those guys, didn't you? End quote. Larson vehemently denied these accusations, and reiterated that they chose to do nothing when they saw Joel and were intimidated by his size. It's hard to say for sure what occurred here. It's certainly possible that some combination of the men went up to Stay to start an issue, and Joel intervened, which resulted in his murder. But I have one particular problem with this theory. Why would these men, who had a major issue with Stay, have so viciously beaten Joel and yet let Stay not only survive, but be capable of walking away on his own? It's certainly possible that Joel got involved and their rage turned to him, affording Stay the ability to escape, I suppose. It's also possible that the blood on Stay's clothing could have been a result of him being nearby while the other men murdered Joel. The police, though, managed to track down these men that night and did not report blood being on them. John DeZiel, Josh's younger brother, was shaken and crying when they found him, but he claimed it was due to a breakup. Larson lied about his name and address and was aggressive, but also drunk, and perhaps he was worried about something else? It's all speculation, but this is a possibility which has to be considered. Joel was a big man, and it's hard to imagine that the much smaller Stay was able to beat him so brutally without Joel getting some shots in and having offensive wounds on his hands or body. For two or more men to attack Joel, it would have been easier. One detail, though, which makes me question this theory, is that no one on the party bus had anything to say about seeing anyone do anything to Joel. Nor did anyone see anyone come onto the bus with any indication of a fight. Joel was very badly beaten and was bleeding profusely. The attacker or attackers would have had blood on them, and that wouldn't have been easy to conceal when all you're wearing is a Halloween costume. I do believe there is the possibility that one or more of these men could have been involved, or know more than they're telling, but unfortunately, we just don't have the evidence to back that up. Police also may have been somewhat guilty of having tunnel vision during the investigation, and once they found out the details about Stay, they essentially ruled all the others out. This may have been a mistake, which could have prevented justice, but it's hard to argue against their theory, which leads us to the final theory, that Travis Stay, despite an acquittal, was in fact the man who murdered Joel Lovelian. Travis Stay has all of the details you'd expect to find in the man who murdered Joel Lovelian. He was present at the bar that night, was seen near Joel, was acting violently according to members of the party bus, as well as a man he allegedly attempted to assault later. He was blackout drunk, had Joel's blood on his clothing, to this day can't remember most of the night, and had wounds consistent with having been in a fight. So with apparently a great deal of evidence to suggest that Stay committed the crime, how was he found innocent? Quite simply, because there were too many other options. From the other guys on the bus, to a total stranger, anyone could have been responsible for murdering Joel, and though Stay seems like a perfect suspect, a jury disagreed. There are some details about Stay which don't fit. One that sticks out to me is that, if indeed Joel's presence is what stops Stay from being harassed by the other men, why would he then turn and lash out against him? It doesn't make a great deal of sense that you'd attack a man who essentially protected you. Then again, Stay did allegedly random attack others that night. Another is the tremendous size difference, with Joel being at least 6 inches taller and having an approximate 55-pound weight advantage. Well, certain things have to be factored in. I've never seen details of the autopsy to discuss Joel's blood alcohol level, and if he'd been intoxicated himself, his reflexes would have been slower and he might not have seen it coming. Also, Joel was known as a kind-hearted man who didn't start trouble. He wasn't likely to attack Stay if he could have just tried to defend himself and fallen over or been tripped and as a result was viciously beaten without being able to protect himself all the way. Again, it's all speculation. While the evidence seems to suggest Stay could have been involved, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's what happened. The thing that makes me the most curious is Joel's blood being on Stay's clothing. At a minimum, this means Stay was nearby when the attack happened or in the immediate aftermath. If he hadn't been so drunk, He may have possessed details which could have led to the apprehension of the killer, or his entire story about not being able to remember could be a ruse which, when applied in court, worked really well. Short of Stay changing his story, or new information coming forward, we may never know exactly what his involvement was, if any at all. Even if we did find out, he couldn't be brought to trial again. Stay's defense team alleged that Larson, Josh DeZiel, and Mitchell Dalen had shouted at Joel and used obscenities, instigating a scene, but this was not something that could be said for sure, since Stay himself couldn't remember exactly what happened. It's a very confusing rabbit hole to go down, but there's simply not enough hard evidence to prove Stay committed the crime. There was only enough to say that he could have committed it, may have been present when it happened, and had obviously been involved in some kind of altercation. But remember, Stay went to the police. He cooperated, handed over his clothing, submitted to questioning, and never asked for a lawyer until he was charged. Those are not typically the actions of a man who knows he's guilty. So the question really becomes, did Travis Stay murder Joel Loveline and lie about it, or did he simply not remember doing it, which made him believe he was innocent? We may never have the answers to this question, and though in the eyes of the law Stay is innocent, he remains a possibility. I do believe that there is a likely 50% chance that Stay committed the crime. I think it's a complete coin flip between either Stay or some of the other men from that party bus. The murder of Joel Loveline is a terribly sad story, with a kind man being killed in an incredibly violent fashion. The list of possible suspects reads like a bad comic book, and the one man who authorities believed was responsible was found not guilty. So where do we go from here? Unless further information is discovered, someone comes forward, or there's some remarkable break in the case, this murder will sadly remain unsolved. For those who love Joel, it's a tragic and heartbreaking thing to have to live day after day, knowing that someone stole away a father, a fiancé, a son, and a brother, and that the culprit is still walking the streets. While they acknowledge the jury's decision, it's difficult for them to see past Travis Stay. Whether or not Stay committed this crime is also something he will have to live with for the rest of his life. For while he was found not guilty, the court of public opinion is typically not ruling in his favor. Hopefully, someday, we can find the answers, and Joel's family can finally know the truth. Until then, this case remains open, cold, and unsolved. If you're interested in finding more information about the murder of Joel Loveline, there are many websites and forums that cover the case, as well as an episode of Dateline. If you have any information about the murder, please contact your local police or the FBI. Who do you believe murdered Joel Loveline? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. If you'd like to support Trace Evidence, please visit the Patreon page located at patreon.com/traceevidence. I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Trace Evidence and invite you to check out our website at trace-evidence.com. You can find links to the Patreon, social media accounts, as well as places to go to download the podcast and subscribe. I'm always eager to hear your feedback. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a good rating on iTunes and leave us a review. This will greatly help our reach and bring more attention to the cases I cover. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence. I'm going to leave you now with a special offer just for Trace Evidence listeners. Exclusively for Trace Evidence podcast fans, today's episode sponsor, True Crime Magazine, is giving away 100 two-year subscriptions for only $20. That's a $100 and more value. Yes, you heard that right. And the offer gets better and better. For the next 48 hours, they're slipping two more best-selling true crime publications worth $139.99 into all ultimate bundles with little to no additional cost. Head over to thecrimemag.com/traceevidence to learn more.